welcome to the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important classics and contemporary films. I'm Chris, and with me, as always, on the couch is my wonderful co-host, Tom.
Hello.
And Colleen's over there in the corner as well. Don't know if we'll hear from her this episode or not.
No, I didn't really watch it.
Alrighty then.
She watched 40 minutes of the film.
Watched the first 20 minutes, and it was lovely. It was pretty. That's it.
But what is the film?
The pretty film in question is the Powell and Pressburger 1947 film Black Narcissus.
As opposed to Black Orpheus.
Yes, which is, right off the bat, I preferred this a whole hell of a lot more to Black Orpheus.
I agree with you, wholeheartedly.
Yes.
Let's go for a synopsis straight off the bat.
Yep.
This film... this is by the same guy. We've already done one of his films, I should say.
We've done one Powell and Pressburger film and one Powell film.
Okay. And the Powell and Pressburger film we've seen is Red Shoes.
Yes.
What's the other...
The other Powell film was Peeping Tom.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Which was awesome as well.
Yes.
And this is no exception to the rule.
Yeah.
This one was really nice. But yeah, it is essentially a film about a group of four nuns... that are tasked with climbing the Himalayan mountain to build an educational facility from the ruins of harem of a royal figure.
Yeah, I think so. Like an old palace,
yeah.
Converted into a new convent, so that they can teach the local children, educate them, and then also teach them about God and religion.
Jesus.
Yeah.
We get to watch the drama that ensues.
We get to go along for the ride.
This whole film was it was fantastic on so many different levels. It was so fucking subtle and rich to take in. This is my first viewing, and I assume it's your first viewing.
Yeah, this is my first as well, yeah.
But like, it's one of those films where you just need... I feel like you need multiple viewings to take in everything that's going on with these shots and the characters and the themes.
Yeah, like, I mean, right off the bat there, you're talking about the themes right there to kind of jump in and say, like... I found on this viewing that, with all the other Powell and Pressburger films I've seen, like, with Red Shoes, for example, like, right off... pretty early on, you're established, like, what... thematically is going on with that film and what you're in store for and like what your story arc is going to be. Somewhat similar as well with Peeping Tom, although you've got a little bit of a mystery happening there. This one I thought was equally large in terms of scope and scale, but I think a lot, like you were saying, a lot subtler with its themes, and it took me a while to kind of grasp onto what the film was doing and saying, I guess, but once I kind of got there with it, fucking enjoyed the shit out of it.
Because you have all of these nuns
that are
trying their best to hold true to their ideals.
Yeah.
And this is what this film is about, is what do your ideals... how important are your ideals, and how far do you go before they start to fall apart, before you can no longer tolerate them? And as such, it was so much more organic. Like, it lets you experience these characters you have, which maybe, let's talk about the four nuns.
Yep.
And their journeys. So you have... Do you have their names written down, by the way? We'll have, like, the monarch of the four. What was her name?
Sister Clodagh.
Sister Clodagh.
Sister Clodagh was the main one. Yeah. And there was Sister Philippa, Sister Honey, Sister Bryony, and Sister Ruth. There were five of them.
Oh, I thought there was four of them.
Five.
Did one die?
Well, yes, but spoiler alert, we'll get to that.
Well, let's start with... I thought it was interesting that Sister Clodagh, you would... throughout the first half of the film, I mean, maybe even the first two-thirds of the film, you would kind of... have moments where she would have her past bleed in and out. There's instances where she's living on the in the palace, and certain aspects of living there remind her of her past. And so you get this sense that she's been living in Ireland, and her she used to have a suitor, I suppose coming from a rich family, because she seemed to be very enchanted.
She's very affluent, yeah, and she gets given emeralds and shit.
Yeah, very, and she fucking really loved that kind of shit.
What I thought was interesting about that, like, the idea of being given these kind of brief little flashbacks was that it, especially with this character as well, because the way we're presented to her in the present is a very straight-laced, down to, like, strictly no-nonsense all business, like, She's the nun put in charge of this new convent.
Mm.
So she's like, no fucking around, I'm doing this proper. And so she's very down, very straight and down the line.
Disconnected emotionally.
Yeah, which is why it's really wonderful that we get these little glimpses back into her past that give us, as the audience, like these glimpses that, like, you know, she is a human being and she's not always like this, but, like, you know, understand that, yes, she is strict and brutal, but there is a human being in a actual character underneath all of this, and it's really, really brilliant choice to kind of add those little flourishes in there.
Well, it insinuates that you have a nun that is now pushing down any sense of a desire for anything.
Yeah, she's suppressing everything just in terms of running the order, I guess.
And you don't see that in the other nuns through these visions, but you get it's insinuated by their actions. You have the sister that plants flowers instead of
the vegetables, potatoes
and whatnot. And I mean, and that's an interesting situation there, because you're going to have she's fighting for an ideal for beauty, where she's putting, like, an ideal for beauty above, you know, the completely bare essentials for living.
Although she did say she did plant some vegetables down in the back end where no one can really see
them. But I mean, that's
beside the point at this point. You're kind of onto something there that I was picking up on as well, where that every other nun seemed to, at least to some degree, have kind of show their emotion or their character more on their sleeve than our main nun, Sister Clodagh, did. Like, they all seem to have a little bit of a characterization, whereas this woman, brilliantly played by Deborah Kerr, is just very, as you said, like, almost, like, emotionless and kind of very robotic, almost.
Well, she's definitely trying to suppress that characteristic.
Yeah.
Like, a natural characteristic
of
any human.
Whereas every other one seems to somewhat have theirs revealed fairly early on, so we get, as an audience, we get a sense of who they are. But we're still given that intrigue on this main nun of, like, we got nothing from you yet, so I'm kind of, it's that hook where you want to know what her deal is, I guess.
Yeah, well, I wanted to actually know Sister Ruth's, who later on becomes completely broken by the altitude. Everyone says it's the altitude that breaks them, but it might just be...
I have a what-if scenario we can get into towards the end about that, but yeah.
So Sister Ruth has been broken by the so-called altitude. And she goes off the fucking rails.
Yeah.
And I think the film is trying to give you an indication, like giving you an image of the extreme case of someone that has gone completely against their ideals and just thrown them all away and just become just a naturalistic animal.
Yes.
Thinking of a point that it keeps dropping away. This film's too complex. My reptile brain.
No, I see where you're going with it. But it's interesting that in terms of pacing and the narrative of all of that, like we eventually get to this point where, you know, we get the reveal of Sister Ruth and what you were saying just then. But there's a good hour of almost build up of just pure character development. There's no real narrative story to the film. There is no real narrative to this film. It is purely a
character study.
It is a complete and utter character study. Like, the base synopsis is five nuns moved to, you know, convert a church, an old palace, into a monastery in the Himalayas.
See what happens.
Watch this for 2 hours, and it's just... Yeah, it is pure character.
There is another character we haven't mentioned, Mr. Dean.
Yes.
Who is... living down at the base of the mountain, or close to it.
Yeah, living in the local village, and he's kind of the handyman, I guess, of the village.
Yeah, I wasn't quite clear on what his actual role was, but he seems to be...
He seems to be, because they are somewhat westernized there. They've got, like, you know, you've got the general who's in charge of the young general who's in charge of the village, who speaks English and is kind of somewhat adopting the Western culture a little bit, and it seems like he, or at least his family, has employed Mr. Dean to kind of...
He's the troubleshooter, it seems.
Yeah, that's it. If there's something wrong, like, you know, there's the one point early on in the film when the nuns are kind of getting the monastery ready and things, that he's working in the plumbing. He's like, oh, you know, I do a bit of plumbing, a bit of building, a bit of everything.
You fix the wireless.
Yeah. All you gotta do is unplug it and plug it back in, you'll be fine.
Yeah. Turn it off, turn it on again, you'll be fine.
Yeah.
And he rides around a ridiculous donkey, too.
Oh, that, can we talk about that? I almost had to Google this. I didn't end up doing it, but I just, because I didn't want to, you know, seem stupid in front of my girlfriend, but it was like the idea that does everyone in the Himalayas ride Shetland ponies?
Yeah, I don't know.
Like, there's so many horses in this film, none of them full size.
It might be historically accurate to ride them, but at the same time, you've built a sexually vibrant masculine male. And as soon as you put him on a donkey...
That was the best scene ever, was when he was drunk at like Christmas and had to like be taken home. And he fucking lazily puts his leg over and he's just swaying, riding this little tiny fucking donkey. And his feet are mere centimetres. He might as well just be straddling and kind of walking along with his horse. Like, it's so crazy. So, so crazy.
Yeah, I felt that was odd, but at the same time, it's like... What else?
Makes it visually interesting.
I guess so. But speaking of, let's go back to just setting ideals for the nuns that they're all reaching towards, these perfect ideals. He was kind of the counterpoint to all of that. Initially, very on, you know that this guy is just run of the mill. He knows what he likes, and he doesn't feel like he's what's the word? Conservative. Like, he's not really he doesn't really think that it's there's a need to suppress your ideals, and he seems to be more in key with like the naturalistic side of humanity.
Yeah. Well, what I ended up writing down, like, and when we're first kind of introduced to Mr. Dean, is that I just ended up writing down a couple of adjectives. I wrote down that he's a scoundrel, and he's also lovely and charming.
Oh, he's very charming. Yeah. I mean, he could be the altitude that everyone's talking about.
He also, like, when the first thing we introduced him, he has the great quote of, you'll be doing me a favor when you teach/train the young girls. So he's, like, very clearly setting up that he is just a scoundrel of a man, and...
But he's
charming and lovely.
Yeah, but
like,
at the same time, he's not a rapist. He's not a criminal.
Yes. No. He's
a scoundrel and he likes to play around, but he's not.
He's a Han Solo.
He's a Han Solo. Yeah. He's an Indiana Jones.
Yeah, but I did think, like, watching the film though, his mannerisms, and in particular the way that he dresses, I think, is very much so what I'd imagine Americans in the late 40s. Thought Australians were like.
But this is a British film.
That's true. But, like, I'm saying, like, he's a very stereotypical American idea of,
it's
like, up until, like, you know, the 80s.
It's a
Crocodile Dundee.
Yeah.
That being said,
Steve Irwin.
He looks exactly like most people around Brunswick and Fitzroy look like these days, so.
It's very accurate portrayal of an Australian.
Yeah.
But are you sure that. Does he specifically say that he's an Australian?
He doesn't specifically say, but there is. Really fucking bizarre inflections on, like, first of all, he's wearing the Akubra hat and stuff, and like the kind of carefree attitude. I think, like, that sounds like I'm just being like, fucking good on you, mate. Australia, carefree, mate. But no, he's just,
we're closely associated with Canadians.
Yeah. There was a weird inflection on certain words where, like, there was one scene in particular, like, very early on, where about every fifth word he'd put a weird little twang on it to make it kind of sound. He'd be like, well, if you want to go and get a haircut.
Okay.
Then it was a little bit like...
It's rough around the edges.
Yeah.
But that's... To be honest, Australians in the 40s and the 50s, they sound pretty British anyway.
Yeah.
So maybe... I'll give it to you. Maybe he is. But if I don't hear it, I don't say, where are you from, Australia? Then I'm not...
I'm from Perth, you can't.
Yeah.
Back is marched.
Yeah.
But
he's definitely
Where the fuck are you from? You from fucking Werribee?
nah, mate, Frankston. But I thought, like, he is a wonderful, like, continuing on with Mr. Dean, he's a great counterpoint, in particular to Sister Clotard. Like, just a...
Harvey!
But yeah, kind of continuing on the point of, while we're on Mr. Dean, like, I think he works absolutely perfectly as a counterpoint to Sister Clotard, like, and they're kind of... Like I was saying, like, with the overall arc that we end up getting, like, the idea of suppressed emotions and versus, you know, he's the perfect guy who's just kind of, you know, does what he does, and then we've got, you know, then we go to the extreme later on with Sister Ruth that is, you know, emotions taken control and gone wild. But it's really wonderful before we get
well,
to
that. Well, it's almost like that's a neuroses, I think. It's insanity
because you've
suppressed. Like, it's not.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's like an unhealthy.
Yeah, no, but I'm saying, like, before we get to that point, though, like, it's nice to see. Have him as the nice kind of yin to the yang of the nuns.
Even there's that point when you said that he's drunk and he's dragging himself away on the donkey.
Yeah.
And he's singing a song in a drunken state where it's along the lines of. Thank God he's not a fucking nun.
Yeah, yeah.
Because then he wouldn't be able to experience pleasure.
And wouldn't be able to be drunk riding a donkey right now down a fucking hill in the lakes.
And that is one of the most strongest points for the character, because it's at that point he's making it perfectly clear that all this suppression of pleasure is to go against your humanity. And, you know, you'll see the consequences in the character Sister Ruth.
Yeah.
So he becomes kind of almost like the focal point. He's not really the focal point of the film, but he's completely essential in every single aspect of the
film. Yeah. Initially, you kind of think of him like, I don't know about you, but watching this, especially in the beginning parts, I had the feeling that the film was like kind of gonna unravel itself in the sense of, oh, she's gonna fall in love with Mr. Dean, and that's what this is gonna be. It's gonna be a kind of chaste romance and love story almost. But it's like, no, not at all. But he's kind of set up as that kind of foil, but he's paid off in like such a brilliant way otherwise.
Yeah, well, I mean, he goes towards the end. It was when Sister Ruth is breaking down. She travels down towards him, enters his house, and kind of just presents her vagina.
More or less, yeah.
And he just goes, don't be ridiculous.
I'll take you to the fucking town. And
he had that on
the
platter.
Yeah.
And I kind of half expected him to take it. But he didn't, to his credit.
He's an honourable man.
Don't put your dick in crazy.
I really hope that, like, because Mr. Dean's a handyman, I hope he has that, like, beveled into a piece of wood above the fireplace.
That's his past. If he had a flashback.
Dick and crazy.
He put dick in crazy once before and never again.
And now that's why he's living in the Himalayas.
He moved to the mountains. And then the nuns came in and fucked his shit up.
Yeah, he's like, God damn it.
God damn it.
He was kind of sad to see them go at the end, which was kind of nice.
Yeah, we're jumping around, like...
We are all over the... But, like, again, crazy. I think it's going to be the problem with, like, I was kind of worried going into this episode, like, how we were going to structure it, because, as I said earlier, there's no real narrative to the film. So, for this one, I think it's okay. Like, we've kind of touched on thematically, and we've started to delve into characters, I guess, like, in particular Dean and stuff. Like, do you want to kind of continue on that road?
I suppose so. We'll keep going.
Like, we've got our three main characters, really. I mean... Oh, no, we've got a few more. Like, you know, there's Clotard, who we've said is a very kind of almost emotionless robot, who we get the kind of glimpses of the past and yada yada. Ruth, who is just crazy. develops crazy.
It's unfair to... She's not a simple character, but you don't ever get to have... If there's any fault in the film...
There's not enough time set
for me. Yeah, you don't get to have you don't get to ever see her perspective.
No, and you never get to see her transition either, I thought, because it was just one of those like snap things, like all of a sudden, like, oh, what the fuck happened to her? She is batshit crazy all of a sudden, and wide-eyed and evil grinning. What is going on? I wrote down in my notes, like, she's just turned into a fucking Snidely Whiplash. Like, she's just turned into a, like, cartoon villain. What's going on?
Well, I don't know. She's not that cliche. She's still...
The way in which she's framed in the shots, I think she is, like, 100%.
Are you talking about towards the end? Because the shots that you see of Ruth in the first half of the film, or the first two-thirds, where she's kind of sick or she's fed up, she just looks kind of depressed and morose.
And you get the idea, yeah, and she just seemed like the bitchy one.
Yeah, she's the bitchy one. But then at the end, it's very much like she's evil with ill intent across the board.
Like, okay, like, I know how I can, like, prove, like, what I'm saying about how her, like, evilly thing, like, her, the
after... You said, sorry, you said like six times. Just
yeah, like. I apologize. Yeah, so the actress is Kathleen Byron. Look at her fucking IMDb page photo. Like,
oh, why did they choose the Sister Ruth photo?
Yeah, well, for Sister Ruth.
Has she only done that film?
No, weirdly, coincidentally, like, goes back to what we were talking about over dinner. She is in Saving Private Ryan.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
She who?
She plays old Matt Damon's wife.
Oh,
at the cemetery.
At
the cemetery.
Yeah. It's a very supporting role.
Very, very.
It's a shame because she's really bloody good.
Yeah, she. That's it. Yeah, everyone in this film is actually
excellent,
top notch. But like, just continuing on with characters, I kind of want to get on to a little bit, like, because the other three nuns are kind of sounding board. They're not really in it that much. Like, it's not really their story, so they're just there, I guess. But
I always thought that they're going to be. In the back, they felt like they're in the background, but at the same time, they're experiencing the same problems from a slightly different angle. We already touched on.
That's what I was saying. Like, they're kind of a sounding board for Sister Clodagh and things, to kind of bounce ideas and, like, emotions and all of that off. But I want to talk about the general and Kanchi a little bit, if we could. The two main kind of local characters we get.
The general is he's a prince.
Yep.
And he is going to be a ruler.
Yes.
And he is very interested in becoming westernized.
Yes.
And then you have she's a 17-year-old woman.
Yep.
Very attractive woman. That seems to be kind of like a street rat that Mr. Dean has found.
Yeah, she's kind of the village bike, and she's a little bit too crazy to be married off, and so no one in the village really knows what to do with her, so let's give her to the nuns.
Okay.
And
she never says a word, by the way.
Yeah, very interestingly played in brownface by an actress named Jean Simmons.
Brownface, Cole.
Brownface.
I thought so.
Yeah, that the woman who's playing Kanchi, you guys probably know, she is the voice of Sophie in Howl's Moving Castle.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Old Sophie, but here she is being horribly racist. Why don't you not
save
fault,
the tribute to fault. The end of the episode?
But
asshole.
But it is really interesting. Like the general.
No, it's like Ben Kingsley was Gandhi. Goddammit.
Yeah, I
know. it's not racist.
But no, the general I want to talk about in particular for his character development. Like you were saying, he initially is presented as a guy who's very embracing. He's the guy who brought the sisters in to kind of convert this place and teach the children of the village so that they can become more knowledgeable and westernized and kind of grow as a town, I guess. And we're given one quick scene that involves him and Kanchi as well. The scene where the old, like, groundskeeper woman is whipping Kanchi because she got caught stealing.
Mm.
And the prince comes along, and the old woman gives him the rod and is just like, you know, here you go, become a man.
Discipline this woman, become a man.
Become a man. And he chooses not to and instead forgives her and embraces her. Which is like, great, I've viewed it as this wonderful character development for this young prince of like, oh, he is adjusting to his to new times, I guess, and kind of subverting the idea, because the older woman as well actually says, be a great ruler like your grandfather was and whip this woman. And he's just like, no thanks.
Okay, I see where you're coming from. So this older woman, she has the idealistic vision that to be a good ruler, you must be just like...
Rule with an iron fist,
almost,
and, you know, have subservience have your subjects be, you know, submissive to you, I guess.
Yeah.
But he chooses not to, and he's trying to become a learned man and going through that path, which I thought was like, yeah, this is wonderful character growth, which makes it so sad that at the end of the film, he has decided to shun all of that. Like, his arc, as it ends up being, he decides to... he can't, given the like what has transpired at the monastery with the young boy, the baby dying, and then Sister Ruth dying, and all this horribleness, that he can't abide this, and he's going to rule with an iron fist like his grandfather did. It's
ironic because their system, the nun system, which is they're trying their best to fit in with the ideals they have. He is trying to break away, but as a result
of their influence of, and their ideals. Crushed him back into a former cycle.
Into their destructive cycle.
Yeah.
I mean, the film, the more I think about the film, the better it gets, the more complicated it gets.
Yeah. There's a lot going on here, but you've got to really kind of delve for it, I guess.
This, let's talk about now, for a little while, let's talk about framing and composition.
Yeah.
And the way that that these scenes are constructed. Because if you gave this film to most directors, I think that it would be a fucking mess.
Yeah.
There is so much going on in each frame. I've taken some screenshots. We'll put some up on Twitter.
Yep.
There's so much going on in each frame that develops the characters and develops the mood and atmosphere. Together with fucking together with the music, together with
this
film's very good.
But I think that's the we've seen that before with Powell and Pressburger films. Like, that's what they are famous for, is like, really, they're very visual storytellers, and they like do it to a fucking T, and this is absolutely no exception. Like, it is, the visuals is the main drawing card for this film. Like, going into it, like, I knew nothing about the story or the themes or the narrative or anything like that. What I knew going into this was that this is a brilliantly visual film. Mm. Like, that's all I knew about it, and it's kind of widely regarded as like one of the most beautiful films of the 1940s.
I would say that it's a masterclass in matte paintings.
Yes. Oh my god, can we please talk about the matte paintings for a little bit?
Yeah.
I can hardly stop being awake.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Really sorry if you can hear that on the microphone, by the way.
Harvey's snoring.
I don't know. Is that loud enough to be heard on there?
It's probably a waveform. Let's check for a waveform. That's a pretty big waveform. Oh, well.
Matte paintings. Yeah, the matte paintings. I was struggling to think of, like, another film I have seen kind of utilize them as beautifully as this one did.
All the trick photography, especially there was I think some of the most vivid and amazing shots were those bird's eye views shot down the mountain along the cliffside where the bell is being rung.
The ones that give you a perspective of how high they actually are and, you know, where they are in their surroundings. It's just absolutely fucking gorgeous.
It's interesting that it's a 1947 film. It's come out of just post-war World War II, and it's nice that you would make a film like this then, because it's so after the war, everyone's feeling like fucking bummed out and shitty. You get a film that's talking about how righteous are your ideals in such a lovely kind of surreal, mystical place.
Yeah.
And for the British public, I would imagine that it's so welcoming it's like the perfect fucking film to present to somebody after a world war.
Yeah, it's just an idea of kind of having going on in a journey inside yourself, I guess, versus like an exterior journey.
Yeah. And I think that those matte paintings are just the vehicle to get into thinking about that situation.
Like, how big and grand this world is, I guess.
I'd love to see, a Wes Anderson take on this film, because the sets were very Wes Anderson-y. There was comedy, and there was kind of physical comedy sometimes that was very Wes Anderson-y.
And I think the colour palette as well was very...
Yeah.
Kind of reminiscent of some of his films. in terms of like the actual surroundings versus the actual characters themselves. Like each character seemed to have a, their own kind of style and color palette, which was kind of masked beautifully with the actual buildings and the landscapes themselves.
He would never. I don't think he would ever do a film that has such dark themes, but.
No,
but it, as we were saying, as I was saying before, like what kind of director could make this? Not very many. Wes Anderson might be one that could actually do this kind of story and these kind of characters justice.
Possibly P.T. Anderson, maybe.
Yeah, P.T. Anderson. Yeah,
yeah.
There's no need for a remake, though.
No, absolutely not. No,
I mean, especially it's like a Technicolor film in for 47.
Yeah,
is that common?
Not really, no. I did have this entry, and I'll probably go into it a little bit more when we get there. But, the guy who invented Technicolor and the people at Technicolor viewed this film as the benchmark and the perfect example of what Technicolor could be.
Mm.
And this was, like, kind of the film that was shown. It was like, this is what you want to do.
Sometimes Technicolor, I feel, is better than kind of just regular colour now.
Yeah.
Somehow it just...
It adds a richness while at the same time saturating, I guess.
At times, if you do it right, if you do it like this film has been doing it, then it has a depth that is lost if you were to just do it in a regular colour sense.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is.
No, I think in this case as well, it almost...
Saturation.
Yeah, and it kind of works as well with the general themes of the film almost, like the idea of the saturation and the kind of... It's muted, but it's not at the same time. It's
the saturation.
Yeah, that's the word.
Let's say that about 8 times in a sentence. Again.
I mean, kind of continuing on with the visual stuff, like, it's not just the matte paintings that are fucking beautiful as well to look at. Like, the actual camera work itself that's done in this is fucking brilliant. Like, the beautiful shots, like, that show off the grand scope and the scale of the palace when they all first arrive and when Mr. Dean's kind of giving them the tour. And there was one sequence later on that really stood out to me, and it's when there's the kind of confrontation between Sister Ruth and Sister Clonard. When Ruth comes in and is like, "You're in love with Mr. Dean," and blah, blah, blah. And they kind of have this interrogation and sort of like a standoff between the two. And we're presented this really quick shot from the point of view of Sister Clonard. And she's looking at her fingernail and how she's got one fingernail that's kind of growing out a little bit long.
Yeah,
and then she pans down, and then it pans up to Sister Ruth. Like, it's fucking brilliant.
It's a weird shot. It's not. It's an abnormal shot.
But it immediately, like, puts you in the point of view of Sister Clonard, and it perfectly expresses all the emotions, and it kind of what Sister Ruth is confronting her about is like brilliantly mirrored in like just the simple glance down to a fingernail. You get instantly like.
And there's an odd pan to the Bible.
Yeah.
And then a pan up to Sister Ruth's kind of haunting eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that shot is very strange.
Yes.
It doesn't fit in, but like it doesn't fit in with every other shot that's in the film.
Yeah.
But because of that, it gives it. It really. Like, lives and breathes.
Yeah, and it conveys so much of what is actually going on with the themes and the actual story of what's happening. It's fucking amazing.
This film is very good.
It's very, very good. I know, was there anything else you kind of wanted to really jump on? Like, was there anything else that was kind of stand out for you before we move on to, like, my what-if theory that I kind of likened this to?
I can't think of anything. I feel like you could talk a lot about it.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. We could just keep going.
The philosophies in it and, like, yeah.
I have a feeling, though, we'll...
Are we going to talk about the finale? Like, the
Sister
Ruth
we haven't really gone into that much, yeah, if you want to...
I mean, because Sister Ruth doesn't renew her vows. And she's clearly... just gone, fuck ideals. I'm going to be a beast.
I'm going to climb down the mountain. I've ordered myself a pretty dress. I've put on my ruby red lipstick. And I'm going to go suck Mr. Dean's dick.
Yes. And what a dick.
But, as we previously established, he does not stick his dick in crazy, which then leads her...
No, but let's talk about the sequence. Like, it's a kind of a very long sequence... where the sequence where Sister fucking what's it Clodagh is kind of cruising down to Sister Ruth's room, and then Sister Ruth is not in her nun's outfit.
Not in her habit.
In her habit. What's that called? That's the outfit.
Yep.
Oh.
That's why Sister Act 2 is cleverly called Back in the Habit.
Oh. That went over my head. 30 years.
Oh, heaven. Whoopi Goldberg, she's a star, damn it.
She's smart. Yeah, and you're confronted with Ruth with her hair. It's like the fact that she just has, you can see her hair now.
Yeah.
Sexualizes her so fucking much.
Yes, yes.
And then the red lipstick, when she puts the red lipstick on, it's just like that fucking lipstick is gonna rock worlds. Hopefully Mr. Dean's world.
Yeah.
And then there's all of these, it seems like it was almost like a different director because the shots became so fucking intense and the build up, the tension in each scene was so brilliantly fucking built.
Yeah.
That it was this fucking trip all the way, I think it was like the last 15-20 minutes or something like that, where it was almost like a horror film.
It was almost like The Shining, man. Yeah.
It was like Jack in the fucking hotel.
You've just hit on my what if.
Oh, right.
Thing, yeah.
Oh, it's like an Indian burial ground or something.
Well, no, it's like, we'll finish your thought and then we'll jump onto this, the kind of similarities between the two.
Okay. Well, no, I just wanted to say that Ruth's, the depiction of Ruth as kind of a demon.
Yes.
Can we try and tease that out? Because she's gone to an extreme, like an insane, she's become insane.
Yes, yeah.
Just like Jack in The Shining.
Yeah.
And it's not an extreme of, it's not the opposite end of the spectrum of Sister Coddard, whatever the fuck her name is. What's her name?
Deborah Kerr. Deborah
Kerr. That's such an easier name.
Yeah.
It's not the opposite end of the spectrum of Deborah Kerr. It's a tangent perpendicular.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Almost
like a isosceles, if you will.
That's a right. You're an idiot. No, so she, I think if we could just focus on this, because this is like the, I think if we draw on the, try and figure out the point of the film.
Yeah, this is where it is, yes.
If you have Deborah Kerr's character maintaining a sense of ideals so hard that you will neglect your, not your humanity, but the just a large portion of your fight. Then you have Mr. Dean, who is the opposite of end of the spectrum, and then you have somebody that has ignored her emotions to such an extreme
that goes to a mental breaking point.
Mm.
Yeah,
I'm trying to work out the point of the film.
I think it's the idea of it's nice to have your ideals, and that's why I think Dean and Deborah Kerr have a kind of nice simpatico at the end, where it's not, you know, they're leaving, Deborah Kerr and the other nuns leaving the village and kind of finally getting out of there and realizing they can't stay in this place. It's not a kind of happy ending for those two. It is very kind of bittersweet because they do have the realization that there needs to be a simpatico between this, that you can't be one or the other,
okay,
because otherwise this happens with Sister Ruth. Like, there needs to be
the connection.
Yes.
If you adhere to your ideals so rigorously,
yeah,
you may lose your humanity entirely.
Yeah, and it's the idea that, yeah, Sister Ruth is the example of that, and it's if Sister Clotted clings so hard to her ideals, she could end up like that. And as well, Mr. Dean as well, being a guy who has just kind of abandoned all of his stuff and is just pure...
There's a middle ground
base
that one must reach.
Exactly.
And that kind of makes a lot of sense because one of the final shots, I think the final shot is Mr. Dean having said, "I don't love anybody."
Yeah.
The last shot is him looking away after saying goodbye to Deborah Kerr's character. He kind of looks wantingly towards her and goes, "Am I making the fucking right choice? Am I really..." Like, it gave me the sense that he has his ideals now.
Yeah.
Which are causing him to have a disconnect with his humanity.
Exactly, yeah.
All right. Okay, I'm satisfied. Talk about your theory.
All right. You started to touch upon it there. Like, the film kind of totally shifts gears in the last kind of 25 minutes or so, half hour, 25 minutes, where I just got a severe Shining thing. And it's like, we've been set up periodically throughout it, where constantly the nuns are being told, you can't be in this place. Like, you shouldn't be in here. Mm. Like, you shouldn't be up here in this mountains. There's bad, like, it doesn't bode well for you all. And it's, again, it's that similar, it's just, this film, I would not be surprised, and I would absolutely love it if I found out that Kubrick watched this a lot before going into production of The Shining.
It's almost certain that he saw it.
Oh, 100% sure. I'm dead certain he's seen this film.
But The Shining is based off a book, is it not?
Yeah, but the film version of The Shining is drastically very different to the book.
True.
But yeah, it ends up, the final act ends up being The Shining, replacing Jack with Sister Ruth, and she is just kind of stalking Sister Clodagh through, and it is, she's been driven insane as well, like, by her inner demons and this kind of...
Let's put up, there's a shot where Sister Ruth is looking completely demonic at a doorway.
Yes, yes.
Leading that up
it
towards
is just, it's power. Almost the Here's Johnny moment.
It's the Here's Johnny moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. But let's put that up on Twitter, and yeah, just because I want to see this through and see how accurate this kind of shit is. But you like, it's not far-fetched.
No, and I would kind of love to see someone do either a mashup trailer or...
Someone else.
Yeah, or... I don't have the effort to do that. I got other shit I got to make this in the next coming weeks.
Okay.
but yeah, I would love to see someone kind of re-edit a trailer for this film, making it look like The Shining. I think it'd be doable.
Totally. I agree with you.
But I guess on that note, do you want to move on to a little bit of trivia?
Sure. The altitude might be just the Indian burial ground.
I kind of was wondering.
We have to... do you mind going up on the mountain in the palace and just mining it for a summer?
That's essentially what they do. It's like, this place has kind of been abandoned for a while. We've had some issues with it. Can you go and be the caretakers of this place? One of you might go insane and try and kill the others. Like, it's The Shining.
Are you talking about The Shining, or are you talking about...
I'm talking about Black Narcissus. The 1947 Powell and Pressburg film.
Okay. Because I was confused. I was like...
Both stars, Shelley Duvall. Yeah, so on to the trivia. The film, it actually won 2 Academy Awards for Best Cinematography and Best Art Direction, as well as winning the Golden Globe for Best Cinematography.
Yeah, that's not surprising at all.
Yeah. The much-admired Himalayan scenery was all created in-studio in London, with glass shots and hanging miniatures.
Yeah, isn't it all... It's all fucking studio and a single garden in Sussex or something.
Yeah, well, that was what was crazy. I honestly think if you had told me at any point, like, no, actually, a lot of this is on location, I would have believed it. And then at the end, we're given the title card, made at Pinewood Studios, and my mind snapped.
But this is the thing is... Because it's on set, everything is controlled.
Yeah.
And it looks amazing because it's controlled. But then there is a kind of irony in the film being controlled to this level.
Oh, okay.
Because they're reaching for an ideal. The filmmakers are reaching for an ideal of beauty, just as the sister that put the flowers in the orchid. It's kind of meta.
Yeah.
So it's odd that they making a commentary and breaking their commentary at the same time.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
No, I'm pulling. Yeah, yeah.
It's an odd thing.
Yeah.
It's fucking cool though. It doesn't matter.
Just adds more and more layers.
It's a fucking sophisticated film.
Yeah. I've already talked about how Technicolor viewed this as the best example of technical process. The backdrops were blown up black and white photographs, and the art department then gave them their breathtaking colour by using pastel chalks on top of them.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chalk.
Pastels.
Jack Cardiff, who was the director of photography, came up with the idea of starting the rainfall finale scene by first having a few drops hit the rhubarb leaves before cueing a full-force rainstorm. He personally created the first few drops of water from a cup. And when the scene was actually shot, and Michael Powell was so pleased with the effect that he decided to make the scene, originally the penultimate one, the closing shot. Cardiff, however, was a great fan of the original scene, which had already been shot, that was supposed to follow this one and close the film. To this day, Cardiff amusingly calls this the opening drops of rainfall the worst idea he ever had as a cinematographer.
Well, what was he going to end it on, if not that?
Oh. I didn't do
it. I thought it was fine.
I liked it. I thought it was a nice... Like it adds into that nice element of the sisters not like, you know, that thing of like, oh, you didn't make it till the rains broke, and then it's like as they leave, the rains broke, so they did actually make it. It was a nice little nod in a nice little moment.
Plus, it allows the audience to kind of contemplate what's been happening for a little while. There's nothing wrong with it, but apparently, yeah. Apparently there is.
Apparently he didn't like it. This one's a giant chunk, so please bear with me, though. Through Powell and Pressburger's deal with Rank Productions, the film was assured a solid distribution in the United States. As it turns out, the film... You're already looking lost. As it turns out, the film had only a spotty distribution in America due to censorship problems.
Oh, yeah, censorship problems, yeah.
Powell later observed they couldn't leave the picture with nuns in it alone. Powell and Pressburger were actually aware of the potential of censorship trouble in America before the film was even shot. In April of 1945, a rough draft of the script was submitted to Joseph Breen at the Production Code Administration. Breen outlined his initial concerns to the Rank Corporation, while stating, "While the story is not quite clear and concise to us, it has about it a flavor of sex sin in connection with certain of the nuns, in which our judgment is not good."
Okay.
Yeah. The Breen office, however, passed the finished film in 1947, but in the condition that a foreword was added, making it clear that the nuns were Anglo rather than Roman Catholic.
Really?
Yeah.
So it makes it all right.
Yeah. Indeed, it was with the Catholic League of Decency that Rank encountered the most problems.
Who's that? Who are these people?
Oh, the League of Decency. Yeah. They're like...
They sound like arseholes.
Pretty much. They're exactly what you think they are. They're churchgoers who are just like, no, we must have religion or Bibles in schools and all this. Oh, like, yeah, no. Just nothing untoward. They are horrible people. It's okay to have your own beliefs, so don't force them upon others.
Yeah.
Speaking of forcing, the League of Decency launched a campaign against the film's release. When the film was first reviewed in the Catholic weekly The Tidings, published in Los Angeles, the judgment was harsh. It is a long time since the American public has been handed such a perverted specimen of bad taste, vicious inaccuracies, and ludicrous improbabilities.
This shit is so stupid.
When the Legion of Decency screened the film, it was given a C classification for condemned.
Oh. That's just ridiculous.
Yeah. So, I'm watching this film, it's such a beautiful and lovely film. I just find it absolutely amazing that it could encounter such bizarre controversy.
The beauty of it is that you have nuns that are finally treated like... They're depicted as humans, and it's a very human story that happens to have nuns in it. And then people get all upset because nuns don't think like that, and they're fucking pure and innocent and fucking all that shit.
Yeah.
But they're human. And that's what the film is discussing.
Exactly! And,
it is a conversation.
No, but nuns can't be human because God and Jesus...
And other fictional characters.
I mean, I've got so much more about the Catholic League of Decency, but I'll just do the kind of broad points of, they tried to get the film banned. It still had big openings in New York and Los Angeles. However, it was banned in several cities across the US, such as Detroit and Memphis, and kind of put into this bad kind of position. Production company, the distributor, ended up having to make cuts to the film, and about 900 feet or so were cut from the initial film's release.
Hate is gonna hate.
Yeah, pretty much. So, I just thought it was all interesting to bring up the fact of, like, yeah, it's fucking stupid that this was a controversial film.
Yeah.
Bastards. But, yeah, that's really all I've got for trivia this week.
So what are the special features like?
So the film has recently been, a couple of years ago, it was re-released as a one-disc Blu-ray or a one-disc DVD, and it's also available on iTunes, but if you get the actual physical DVDs, you get a new high-definition transfer that was actually supervised by Jack Cardiff, as well as Michael Powell's widow and editor of the film, Thelma Schoonmaker. The film also comes with a video introduction by filmmaker Bertrand Travernier, audio commentary with featuring Thelma Schoonmaker and director Martin Scorsese, The Audacious Adventurer, a video piece in which Tavernier discusses the film and Michael Powell, Profile of Black Narcissist, a documentary featuring members of the Archer's production team, painting...
We should talk about the title. Because it's the title's named after the perfume
that the general actually wears.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Then Sister Claudia decides she's going to name the general after that.
We haven't talked about the Black Narcissus title. Named after the perfume of the...
I did have a note on it, but I thought it was a little bit... I don't know. It didn't seem all that... Important's not the right word. It just seemed a little bit blasé, I guess. Like, it's the idea of... again, further hammers home that point of Sister Clotta being kind of very sheltered and kind of insular in her own ideas and stuff, and hence when she sees someone who so overtly expresses an idea of, you know, wealth or westernization of culture, like the general does in that scene where he kind of sprays about his perfume.
Extravagant pleasure.
That she's just like, oh, well, he's narcissist. Like, yeah. He's...
That's bad.
Yeah.
They're putting a label on the idea of wearing... The Black Narcissus.
Exactly. It just seemed to, again, hammer home the point that's already been established.
You could just say it's the symbol of what they're striving to not be.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. And the final special feature is Painted with Light, a documentary on Jack Carve's Oscar-winning work on Black Narcissus. as well as the original theatrical trailer and the usual kind of booklet and essays that Criterion always do.
I read a couple of the essays. They're pretty good.
Yeah, I had to kind of flick through them as well.
Some of the things I've said tonight may or may not be lifted directly from them.
Do not read the Criterion essays. that'll, I guess, wrap us up for this week's episode, looking at Black Narcissus.
Highly recommended.
Yes. 100% agree. Holds up, definitely. These guys have not done a bad film yet that I've seen. So
fucking good.
Which means I'm looking forward to next week's film, which is I Know Where I'm Going, another Powell and Pressburger film.
Fucking sweet, man.
Hopefully it holds up. But if you have any comments or queries or think we've missed anything, please send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter @CriterionQuest. But for this week's episode, I'm Chris.
I'm Tom. See you next time.